PlanetRadio.com, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70, and worldwide on the Internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Another edition of American Exposé. I'm Darren Weeks, your host for the next hour on this Monday, the beginning of another week. This is April 11th, 2005. Ladies and gentlemen, last Friday I started sharing with you from a book called The Energy Non-Crisis from Lindsay Williams. And we're going to be having Lindsay back on the program again because, as he predicted on this program, gas prices continue to skyrocket out of control and... This is not going to get any better, folks, because it's orchestrated. There is an orchestrated plan in this country to bankrupt every American here and to bring us down to third world status as a part of the United Nations system. And I think it's important to counter the controlled media's lies with the truth, and that's our purpose here tonight. And it may sound a little bit, cumbersome to listen to if you consider that I'm sharing with you information from a book. Folks, please stay tuned because this information is both interesting and relevant, and I think it's very important for us to all understand Lindsay's experiences as he worked as chaplain on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline back in the early 1970s when it was being built. Some of the insane government regulations that were placed upon the oil companies, and I believe there was 9 oil companies that were involved in this project. And the insanity of these regulations, and it was the environment that is being used as a means to control humanity. And nothing has changed, and this plan has been going on for a long time. And so I thought it was very important for you to hear some of the information, and I've skipped a few portions of the book that are relevant, but not as... I'm trying to get through this. Because I really want you to hear this information, and I'm aware that there are a few out there. Well, there's probably the vast majority out there. We Americans are very busy, and a lot of people don't take the time to read. And I really feel it's important to order this book, and we'll be giving the information to do so as time progresses. I will give you Lindsay's address as it is published here in this book. He may be contacted at P.O. Box 7, Kasilof, Alaska, and Kasilof is spelled K-A-S-I-L-O-F, Kasilof, Alaska, 99610. And there's also a phone number that is published here, and I'm not sure this is updated information, but I'm going to give it here anyway. Hopefully somebody on the other end didn't get this phone number and find out that it was published in a book somewhere, and it's not really them. Not really for Lindsay, but anyway, this is the phone number is 907-262-4000. Again, that's 907-262-4000. And like I said, we're going to be getting Lindsay back on the program again to talk some more about his experiences there in Alaska. But in the meantime, I want to share with you some of this information as I started this last Friday, and I want to continue. And I don't want to yak too long here at the top of the broadcast. because I'll run out of time. Lindsay, just again to give you a little background information once again. I'm trying to find the page where the background information is. Well, anyway, pardon me here. I'll give you background information. He worked as chaplain on the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline back in the early 1970s, and during this time, his whole purpose in going to Alaska was to counsel these people, these men who were trying to build this thing, and he figured this would be a great missionary field. And so it's completely a spiritual endeavor for him. He never had any intention of going there for the purpose of exposing this information. It was while he was working there that the oil companies granted him executive status, which meant that he could go anywhere, see anything he wanted to see, observe anything he wanted to observe. And he even was invited to sit out on executive board meetings, which he, in fact, did. And he became privy to this information, where the government, the oil companies would go and discover various oil finds, and the government would order these finds to be shut down, these oil fields to be not developed. And he began to be convinced, as he was hearing from these oil executives, that there was a deliberate plan by the federal government and those who control it, because we know that many people who operate in the federal government are just puppets. They're receiving orders from on high. But at any rate, he became convinced that there was a deliberate plan to cripple America through energy. Now, I want to share this information with you. He says, "It is not our purpose to give all sorts of details as to the day-by-day administration of the pipeline or of the human nature of the men. There were, of course, the common problems such as theft, with the usual attitude of you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. That is all in big business and government operations wherever human beings are found, working around the face of the globe. Human nature does not easily change, whether those concerned are in Alaska or in the lower 48 states. The sort of graft so often that is associated with private enterprise and big companies is prevalent in many areas. In fact, ultimately, human ambition demonstrates itself in ways that have similar roots, if only we can get back to and understand the scheming behind various operations. Some people are anxious for financial gain, others are more interested in a power structure. When it comes back to the political arena, that power structure might go way beyond mere money. It is possible to relate this to the oil fields and to see some semblance of comparison with what is taking place in Canada. Canada has already nationalized its oil companies. That is an actual fact of history, and this was often referred to by executives of the oil companies working for the pipeline. Often I heard it related that the same patterns that were used by Canada for the nationalization of their oil companies appeared to be the pattern that the United States government was following in its dealings with the oil companies today. The oil company officials in the top echelons have suggested that the federal government wishes to nationalize the oil companies of America. We will elaborate more on this later on. The heading of this chapter is The Workings of an Oil Field. It is relevant to emphasize that the United States government as such did not own anything, equipment, machinery, buildings, or anything else in the oil fields. Not one penny of government money was invested in the pipeline, yet the government exerted all sorts of pressures as they implemented their multitudinous rules and regulations. Neither did the oil companies own all of the equipment. For in many cases, the work was subcontracted, and often the machinery was owned by the company to whom the work was contracted. One official was responsible for all the subcontracting of heavy machinery on the east side of the oil field. At one point, I heard him state that in a 30-day period, he gave out as much as $2 million in contracts for lease of equipment. That man's work is uniquely different from anything else anywhere on the face of the globe, and that is true of so many jobs associated with the oil fields on the North Slope of Alaska. Because of the Arctic climate, many positions have been created and developed that have no parallel at all in any other project. Very often there is no available training, such as university degrees, for the job requirements are unique to the Alaska oil fields, and there is certainly no university found in the tundra of the North Slope. I know of one man who was a sheep herder in Wyoming, and he operated a huge ranch. He came to Alaska because he heard of the exorbitant wages on the pipeline, and he wanted the slice of the cake. He started as a general worker at the very inception of the Prudhoe Bay oil field, and today he is an invaluable executive with Atlantic Richfield. He had no specific training. He was trained on the field, and I personally heard him say that he cannot be transferred because there is no other job like this at any other place on earth. This man is so unique, and he virtually knows where every nut and bolt is at Prudhoe Bay, and he is quite irreplaceable. Mr. X, and that was an oil executive that he's protecting the identity of. You'll know that you'd know this if you heard Friday's program. Mr. X remarked to me one day that if he ever wanted anything, he would simply go to this particular man. He seemed to always know where everything is. Such a man is valuable, if only because of the high turnover of the labor force on the Alaska North Slope. Many of those who have been there for comparatively short periods of time had no idea as to what had gone on before they had arrived, or as to what, as to the way certain activities developed. Over and over again, the very nature of the field demands training that is simply not available anywhere else. This can be found only in the University of Hard Knocks. The Alaska oil field certainly is one big branch of that university. The dorms in which the men lived in the camps were very well appointed. There were two men in each dorm in a 52-room section. Now, I'm going to skip some of this because, folks, in the interest of time, I'm going to skip to a chapter called Toilet Paper Holder for Sale Cheap, Only $375. Now, the reason we're covering this is to give you a little background as to the incredible expenses that were imposed upon the oil companies, which, by the way, are expenses that you are paying for at the pump today, at least partially. And there are so many other expenses like this that are piled upon layer upon layer of regulation and various other things that drove up the cost of the pipeline and the cost for the oil companies and consequently your cost. He says, we said we would mention problems. We do not wish to major on union difficulties, so we shall only give you one example to keep the picture in true perspective. He says, I was sitting with Alyeska's field engineer in the office simply shooting the breeze before getting down to more important business. In walks one of the workers and said, the toilet paper holder is falling off the wall in the commode stall over yonder in B-dorm. Okay, said the manager, and he called in the carpenter. The carpenter came in, dressed for work, of course, and says, hey, Jim, the executive says, hey, Jim, I'd like you to go over to fix the toilet paper holder in B-dorm. Okay, said Jim, and off he went. I watched him go out and vaguely thought that he looked like quite a capable man, really dressed for the part. I thought some of the carpenter jobs around my home I'd like him to do. Surely he would be a lot quicker than I would be, although it would be long before my opinion was drastically changed. The manager and I went on discussing our business and had forgotten about that unimportant toilet paper holder over in B-dorm. 45 minutes went by, and Jim, the carpenter, returned. Now get this, 45 minutes went by, and then finally Jim, the carpenter, returned. He says, hey, I can't do that job over there. There's a metal wall, and it has to have a screw put in it. That's not a carpenter's job. You ought to know that. That's a metal worker's job. The union would not let me do that. You notice that it had taken him 45 minutes to decide that, and he came back to the office, of course. We must allow the man to have time off for a coffee and a cigarette. However, I did think 45 minutes was just a little long. All right, said the manager. and he did the expected thing and called over a metal worker. In due time, the metal worker arrived, and he in turn was told of the urgent need to repair the toilet paper holder on the metal wall in the dorm. Off went the metal worker, and about an hour later, he came back. I was still there, for there were some matters that I needed to go over in detail with the manager. In walked the metal worker, and now I had a job to control myself. Metal worker says, hey, I can't do that. That involves a screwdriver. That's a laborer's job. I'm a metal worker. I just tie metal together. You can't expect me to do a laborer's work. The manager was beginning to feel frustrated, though not all that much, for after all, these things happen so often. All right, he said, I'll send for one of the laborers. And he did. A little while later, a laborer came in, and the manager carefully explained to him what dormitory it was to which he had to go. It was very particular. He was very particular because he had the impression that the man might not be following him too closely. The laborer went off, apparently knowing what it was all about, and the manager and I got down to our business again. It was probably about 40 minutes later that again we were interrupted, this time by the laborer coming in with his story as to why he could not fix the toilet paper holder on that metal wall in B dorm. He said, hey, you can't expect me to do this. That screw you talked about, that's got to go into some wood there. You know that as well as I do. That's a carpenter's job. I'd be on strike if I had to go against the union rules in a thing like this. The manager turned to me, this time really frustrated. He said, what do you do, chaplain? The carpenter can't do it because there's metal involved. The metal worker can't do it because there's a screw involved, and the laborer can't do it because there's a piece of wood involved. What do I do with that lineup of men who are waiting to use the toilet paper? In desperation, the manager now called in the foreman of the metal workers, the foreman of the carpenters, the foreman of the laborers, hoping to be able to figure out some way in which somebody, somewhere, somehow could fix the toilet paper holder onto the metal wall with the little bit of wood over in B dorm. So these foremen came in, each of them being paid now about $25 an hour. The carpenter would have earned something like $15 an hour, the metal worker about the same, and the laborer a little less. So the foremen were called in. The doors were closed. Chairs were drawn up. They sat down to this very important conference. None dare interrupt. It was almost as though the blinds should be drawn in case somebody would happen to see over their shoulders as they seriously discussed regulations for putting toilet paper holders on walls. No, not just walls, metal walls with wood screws, with wood protruding. Metal walls with wood protruding. At last, an amicable arrangement was entered into. It was clearly an excellent illustration of the unity that could be shown by human beings when they set their minds to do a thing. Nothing is too hard for men to accomplish when they are really serious about finding a solution. The conference relating to the toilet paper holder was a glorious demonstration of human ingenuity, friendship, and common sense. Or was it? Of course, you would be very interested to know what the result was. When we tell you, it would be something like the interpretation of Pharaoh's dream in the days of Joseph. Once the interpretation is given, it is obvious. The decision was that the foreman would call up one man from each of their ranks, and those three men would go together to that metal wall with the wood protruding over in B dorm. There was no decision made as to who would actually lift the toilet paper container, but it was agreed that the three foremen themselves would be there to ensure that nobody did anything against the union rules. So the procession went across to B dorm. Unfortunately, the manager and I were unable to go. We couldn't stop laughing long enough. To be honest, we found it hard enough to not laugh until the team of valiant workmen were out of sight. Then we laughed until they came back. We were told later what happened. One man would pick up the screwdriver. The other would pick up the piece of wood. The other would hold the screw. Between them, they eventually managed to get the toilet paper holder back onto the metal wall with a piece of wood protruding without offending any union rules. The three officials were satisfied. The workmen were pleased with their noble day's work, and the line of men that had congregated at the other toilets was reduced as the word went round that the toilet in B dorm was again in working condition. As we say, everything can be done so long as there is a spirit of compromise, fraternity, and ridiculosity. You'd think that was the end of the story, right? Well, not actually. After all, rules are rules. History has the grim habit of repeating itself. Who knows, perhaps one of those men did not do his work properly. It would be a dreadful thing to go into that room and find that the toilet paper holder had fallen off again. Perhaps by that time one of the foremen would be gone, and they would not have a proper reference to be able to see that the matter was through so expeditiously and so harmoniously as it had been done the first time. The manager was a man of great foresight. He recognized the problem, and so he said to the men concerned, Now that you men have done such a good job and have come to such a wise conclusion, we must see that this is properly established in case there's a repeat of this sometime in the future. I must put this down, italics it, for our records. He did just that, and sent an elaborate telex down to Fairbanks. Presumably someone at Fairbanks had the arduous task of deciding into what subsection the new regulation should be inserted in the new operations manual. Looking back, it is undoubtedly funny, and I've laughed many times as I've thought of that particular incident. However, the more serious aspect is that the cost of replacing that toilet paper holder on the metal wall with a small piece of wood attached was astronomical, and it didn't even include the cost of buying the holder itself. I've actually sat down, he says, and calculated what the total cost would be based on the salaries of the men considered. Six men were involved at salaries ranging between approximately $12 and $25 per hour, so the total cost was something like $375. As we say, it has its funny side, but it was also a ridiculous, frustrating waste. Unfortunately, that was typical of so much that took place on the oil fields. By the way, the next time you go over to the gas station and pay over $1.50 a gallon, and now you're paying probably almost $3 a gallon, or in some places more than that, remember that toilet paper holder. Your extra cents are helping to pay for that important piece of engineering, and that is symptomatic of so much that took place while the pipeline was being constructed. As we have said, there were many problems over the union matters, as with various types of labor being required for the simple maintenance of vehicles. There were many irritating delays and unnecessary exorbitant costs. The practice of wobbling became a serious problem. That was what the union men called it. It seemed that everything was piling up all at once. It seemed almost as though there were some underlying force planning this whole thing. Every day was another catastrophe. By now, there were only 6 months to go until the flow of oil. But everything was breaking loose. The whole place was coming apart. The unions had agreements with the oil companies, and they had promised that for the life of the pipeline, they would not strike. The reason that they had promised this was that the men had been given salaries that were exorbitant. Nowhere on the face of the earth could you make that kind of money in these trades, and therefore the unions agreed to sign an agreement that they would not strike. And then some of my own Christian men who were supposed to be honest, came to me and said, "Chaplain, we can't strike, but we can wobble." I asked, "What's wobbling?" And they said, "That's just another way of striking. Instead of leaving the job and not getting paid for it, we just slow down. We just sit in our in the buses and refuse to work because conditions are not right." Who told them that the conditions were not right? Those conditions had been right for 2 years, and in all that time, there had been no wobbling. The conditions were identically the same as they had been through the period of time. So who was telling them that conditions were not right? Why did they decide to start wobbling? And I'm going to skip the details of that and go to the next thing, because, folks, we don't want to focus entirely on union issues. That's just one aspect of it. He says, the manager at Happy Valley Camp called me into his office one day. By the way, his name is Charlie Browns. Charlie Brown. He says, by the time I had begun to notice that some things simply didn't make a lot of sense. Costs seemed to be exorbitantly high. And as time went by, I was to find that this was indeed true in all sorts of strange ways. The initial construction phase of the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline involved building a road from Fairbanks, Alaska, to the Arctic Ocean at Prudhoe Bay. This road is approximately 400 miles long. It is a gravel two-lane road right on top of the tundra. On this northern sector of the pipeline, there were no roads, no people, and no towns. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company had to construct everything from scratch. This road from Fairbanks to Prudhoe Bay is commonly referred to as the Hall Road. On this spring day, the Hall Road was being constructed across a certain area. It is important to know, so that this story will be understood, that the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline Hall Road that ran from Fairbanks to Prudhoe Bay was so designed that it would affect the ecology as little as possible. This might seem strange to most in the lower 48, that is to say all the states excluding Alaska and Hawaii, but I have actually seen a dozer driver lose his job because he accidentally drove the dozer off the main path of the road and dropped out onto the tundra. That's how particular the ecology people were about the protection of the precious tundra. We shall discuss the ecology and environmental protection a little later, but at the moment, let us simply say that in the construction of the pipeline, there were many ecologists checking on everything. There were federal government men, as well as state men, and sometimes you would find these men actually walking out in front of equipment so that they could move away little ground squirrels, oh, jeez, to make sure that no animal was affected in any way by the building of the haul road. Now, folks, are you starting to see the insanity involved in this? And this is why we're covering this, because we want you to understand why you're paying $3 a gallon or around that at this point in time, and why it's going to continue to climb, because there's a deliberate effort to make it do so. Lindsay continues. He says, so this day I was called into Charlie Brown's office at Happy Valley Camp, and he said, Chaplain, you've just got to see what's going on here. I just wasted $2 million. I looked at him wondering what he meant. He didn't seem too unhappy personally, and I knew that he was talking about the company's money and not his own. Never mind, I joked with him. With all the money you've got, you won't miss a couple of million. I must come to you for a loan myself sometime, I joked. The manager smiled, but then became more serious. He says, Chaplain, we talked a lot about the way this Trans-Alaska oil pipeline cost overrun is getting out of hand. I told you that originally the pipeline was supposed to cost $2 billion, and that was and that the cost overrun is building up every day. Well, sir, as you know, we are putting this haul road across the hillside just over Happy Valley, just outside of Happy Valley, and we've been given permission by the government to build the road there. It's not as though we didn't have permission. We've gone through all the right channels, and we're putting in that haul road across the hillside, and we have no reason to doubt that we could get the project done in good time. He paused, and I wondered what was coming. I looked up and saw that he seemed really angry about something. What's bothering you, Charlie? I asked him sympathetically. Well, you'll never believe it. There was a falcon's nest up on the top of the hill. You know as well as I do that the major nesting grounds of the falcons are the Franklin Bluffs around the Happy Valley area. These ecologist creeps want to insist that the falcons along the Sag River are on the semi-extinct list and that they can't be disturbed at any cost. Now we find that those two falcons nesting up there, one of the blankety-blank ecologists found them, and he told us that we'd have to stop the whole job. The whole job? You're not serious, I asked. Never more serious in my life. This creep found them, and he told us that we'd have to stop the whole job. And I mean, he told us we'd have to shut down everything. With all of those hundreds of men out there on the job working, that guy had the authority to tell us we couldn't go on with our construction, even though we've been given permits to build it this way, and we were deeply involved with hundreds of men at work. Lindsay responded, don't give me that nonsense. Okay, this is the guy from the oil company still. He says, don't give me that nonsense, I said to them. You don't really think we're going to stop all this work just so a falcon can sit on its eggs. And that's exactly what I'm saying, he said, this creep told me. You can't go on with the construction until the falcons have finished nesting. And he says, why can't you move the stupid falcon's nest further across the mountain? And Lindsay says, that seemed to me to be a sensible enough question. The guy responded, my job is to protect the falcons. I'll do my job, you do yours. The road doesn't go through until those falcons have finished nesting, Charlie was told. Folks, we got to take a break here. You're listening to American Exposé. I'm Darren Weeks, and I hope, folks, that you're starting to understand why we're sharing this information with you. Because I can't think of anything more important. Well, there's many important things that are going on right now. I hope you'll stay with us as we continue with the information on the other side of the break.
The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests, and are not necessarily those of the First Amendment Radio Network or its affiliated radio stations.
This program on FirstAmendmentRadio.com is much more than entertainment. It is more like an information-packed audio magazine delivered direct to you. Like any magazine, if you don't want to keep getting it, simply unsubscribe by not listening. But you are listening, so now go to FirstAmendmentRadio.com on the Internet and follow the instructions there to make a donation or subscribe to your favorite program. Not only should you subscribe for yourself, but you should give extra to help us spread the message of FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Don't do Internet? You can also write us. First Amendment Radio, 139 East Tulare Avenue, that's T-U-L-A-R-E Avenue, in Tulare, California, 93274. 139 East Tulare Avenue, that's T-U-L-A-R-E Avenue, in Tulare, California, T-U-L-A-R-E, California, 93274. Thank you.
How would you like to add 20 years to your life? Dr. Earl Mandel, the world's number one leading authority on health and nutrition, has revealed one of the most powerful anti-aging foods ever discovered. It's a 2,000-year-old Himalayan health secret called the goji berry. Dr. Mandel says this is the biggest health breakthrough he has ever seen in 40 years. Backed by scientific research and checked under the microscope, they say the goji berry could very well be the most nutritionally dense food on earth. So give your body a real treat. Try this most incredibly delicious, all-natural, 100% juice. Your kids will love it, and so won't your pets. It comes with an unconditional 90-day money-back guarantee. To learn more about the secrets of the goji berry, give us a call at 877-888-4777. That's 877-888-4777.
Music there, bluegrass. As we continue the broadcast, American Exposé, as we're sharing from Lindsay Williams' information, the energy non-crisis. And before the break, we were talking about a pair of falcon's nests as they were building this road that they needed to build. And ultimately, what they did, folks, is they were forced, instead of being allowed to move the nest, they were forced to actually take the road a different direction. To actually take the road around the nest at an additional cost of $2 million. And this is just one of the many examples of the insanity that went on during the construction of the pipeline. And if it went on then, folks, we have no reason to believe that it's gotten any better today. You see? And that's the point. All this stuff is still going on today with various drilling efforts. And in Alaska today, and for what purpose is it other than to bankrupt this country? Why would the federal government, why would our government want us to be dependent upon foreign oil, folks? If it were not for control, we have men and women over there in the Middle East right now fighting and dying for what we're supposed to believe is for oil. Now they don't necessarily come out and say it that way. But for what other purpose would there be? the average American comes to the conclusion, oh, we're over there for oil. But you see, that's operating within their dialectic. When you say that we're over in the Middle East for oil, you are thinking inside the dialectic of the controllers, because that's exactly what they want you to believe. They want you to believe we're over there for oil because, well, the end result of that kind of thinking is to say, well, we have to have oil, don't we? We have to have energy, so the plan has to go forward. Folks, we're not in the Middle East for oil. We don't need the oil. That's the point. That's the point in sharing this information from Lindsey Williams. We don't need the oil. There is a deliberate energy crisis for the purpose of control. That's what it all boils down to. We're in the Middle East because we have an imperialist group of people in our government operating within our government, but also operating within the United Nations system as our federal spooks, are all a part of the United Nations system. The United Nations system is the U.S., and the U.S. is the United Nations system. They admit as much on the State Department website, if you ever go there to read the information. And we have a link at AmericanExpose.com, American spelled with a K, not a C, in the Agenda 21 section, the United States mission to the United Nations. And that's very telling if you go in there and start reading that stuff. Getting back to Lindsey Williams' information, excuse me, he talked about the pair of the falcon nest. Now he's going to talk a little bit about the outhouses, which cost $10,000 a piece, an extra for a Mercedes engine that had to be attached to it. He said there's some rather odd paradoxes in the matter of toilet facilities at Prudhoe Bay, and although the subject matter of this chapter may seem a little bit crude, even though we've discussed the subject as delicately as possible, it is necessary to show to what extent excess expense was forced upon the oil companies, adding to the tremendous budget overruns. At first, it was the official policy to hire only men on the pipeline, it being thought that the rough and tough life that was common to the pipeline was not for women. Then the policy was changed, and a number of women of every age were allowed in as workers. There were no separate facilities for women for the first few months, so they had to live in the same dorms as the men, even using the same bathrooms. The dormitories were built so that 52 men were in the unit. Excuse me. There being two to a room, and the restrooms were at the center. I admit it was somewhat of a surprise to me one day to be in the bathroom and notice under the next door was a pair of ladies' shoes. Apparently it did not embarrass the lady, for she seemed to act as though that was the most natural thing for her to be there, to come out, to wash her hands, and then to go on her way. That was life on the pipeline for some time. You never even knew if the person in the shower stall beside you was a man or a woman. Obviously, sex was an important subject at the pipeline, even when women were not present. There were some places, such as storehouses, where you simply could not look at any point on the wall without sex symbols being depicted. I remember one day when I was working out with Senator Hugh Chance, and our truck broke down. We had to wait a couple of hours in the dorm room that was about 70 feet long and 40 feet across. Both walls were completely papered with nudes from all the pornographic magazines that found their way to Prudhoe Bay. We were there 2 hours. There was nowhere else to go, and about the only way to avoid seeing the pornography was to lie down and go to sleep. Eventually, the women had their own dorms, but one could not help sensing that they were not especially embarrassed by sharing the common facilities. Anyway, skipping ahead here, he says the environmentalists had some weird ideas regarding human waste disposal. And folks, this fits right into Agenda 21 as well. He says while the pipeline was being constructed, the oil companies were forced to use a Hercules aircraft to remove human waste off the slope to Anchorage. The Hercules is a massive four-engine aircraft able to cart something like 48,000 pounds as a usual load. The tail opens up, and the cargo can be loaded. Human excreta was loaded onto Hercules aircraft and tanked all the way to Anchorage, 800 miles away. As it happened, the sewage system was not operating correctly at Anchorage at the time, so the excreta was dumped into the ocean. The sewage at Anchorage went directly into the inlet because the sewage system was not working effectively there. There had been some massive problems with it, and the scheme itself was abandoned for a time. At first thought, the use of a Hercules for this purpose seems incredible, but it is true. The oil companies were forced to take the human excreta from the slopes where there was virtually nobody living. Out there, the excreta could do nothing but fertilize the ground without having an effect on human beings at all, but the companies were forced to haul it down to Anchorage anyway. Well-placed officials made it clear that it would have been far more sensible to set up designated areas where the waste could be dumped, and then all that would happen would be that the grass would grow, the caribou would be fed, and there would be no problem in the sewage because being dumped into the inlet at Anchorage. Obviously, large numbers of people could be affected by the foolishness of disposing of the waste in the way that it was done, but the ecologists were adamant. This was not an isolated incident. There were other places where the human excreta had to be tanked into Hercules aircraft and taken away from the slope. Another example being in association with the building of the Gilbert Lake Camp and the road in that area. One estimate was it cost $6,500 for one round trip by Hercules to get rid of a load of human excreta. Anchorage was not the only place that benefited from this type of unwelcome deposit. Fairbanks was another. And it is now that Fairbanks has the most unsanitary landfill in all the world. This waste was dumped into the river nearby, and it simply washes off. And this, folks, also gives you credence to the reality, folks, that these so-called eco-managers and the environmentalists, they don't really care about the environment. They're using the environment as a means of control. He continues here. He says there were loudly voiced protests that these were deliberate ways to make the oil companies spend large sums of money unnecessarily, and that the fact is that evidence suggests that there is much truth in such assertions. The money that was wasted is almost incredible. Millions of dollars were being spent on mobile sewage treatment plants so that the human waste could be carted off from the drilling rigs and camps. Samples were sent to the state authorities regularly, and they insisted that the tests were run to make sure that the ground itself was not contaminated with human excreta. Excreta that, after all, would simply make the grass grow. The controls were not limited to the federal government, for state regulations were also very stringent. One of the regulations specifically states that all incinerators shall meet the requirements of the federal and state laws and regulations, and maximum precautions will be taken. Human waste is included in the discarded matter that must be gotten rid of, and it is specifically stated that after incineration, the material that is not consumed by the incinerators shall be disposed of in a manner approved in writing by the authorized officer. The state officials decided that the bacterial tanks in use that were fed with air were not acceptable. So they got some long white papers, set the bacterial action going, and whatever was left over was picked up on the paper that was rolled slowly through the water. This then went into a little incinerator and was burned. The ashes were taken to the sanitary landfill and they were buried. In other words, the incinerator was really a kind of an outhouse. A diesel rig was used, and for a 35-man camp, approximately 50 gallons of diesel were used each day. Remember that this was a time when there was supposed to be a diesel crisis, and it was very difficult to get diesel fuel for jet planes. Because of manipulation, diesel was hard to obtain. And yet the state insisted that human excreta be burned up in this way. A Mercedes-Benz engine was used, and it took approximately 350 gallons of diesel each week to run it. As one highly respected official said, quote, "Those Mercedes-Benz engines are burning up 350 gallons of diesel every week just to get rid of human waste, which the tundra desperately needs," unquote. And then he went on saying, "They do things like this in a very wasteful manner, such as using up 100 pounds of propane every 3 days just to get rid of some human turd." Ever since life began, you simply put it on the ground, and it makes the grass grow. Now, suddenly, it's supposed to kill the weeds, or kill the grass. I haven't figured out that one yet, this person said. Oh, man. These things are not hearsay, Lindsay says. We're not giving you rumors or secondhand material. Let me tell you about one day I personally investigated a $10,000 outhouse. I had set out one day to go out to a work site riding with one of the engineers at Franklin Bluffs Camp. I often got into trucks and rode all day with one or another of the men in order to be out where the men were. I wanted to be right on the work site and to find out as much as I could. I was anxious to share with the men in real-life situations and not simply see them on my terms. I had executive privileges, and so I was free to come and go as I liked. I enjoyed the drive out with this engineer, and of course, we talked at length about many aspects of this fantastic project. The engineers are often proud to tell you that they are engaged in what is believed to be the greatest engineering project ever undertaken by man in all the history of the world. They believed in what they were doing, but over and over again, they were frustrated by the limitations set upon them by the endless regulations that are so often needlessly enforced. They believed that there were deliberate efforts to slow down the project and escalate its cost. So on this particular day, I was riding with the engineer out from Franklin Bluffs. There was one of those outhouses out on the job site in the middle of nowhere. I turned to my engineer friend and I said, "Hey, you mean they even have to have privies up here in the middle of nowhere? The tundra certainly needs manure. It would be a good idea to fertilize it. After all, there are lots of animals coming through here, and I haven't heard of anyone trying to put diapers on the caribou yet." Well, the engineer answered, "We don't dare drop any waste up here, even though the men will be here only a few weeks. According to the government officials, we must not fertilize the tundra, because that might not be good for it. We've been instructed to put outhouses in so that so many miles up and down the haul road of the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline, and to have one for every so many men." I looked at him, hardly able to believe my ears. Here we were out in the middle of nowhere, an intelligent people, products of Western civilization in the 20th century, were seriously suggesting that high-quality outhouses must be put up at regular points. I chuckled and said to the engineer, "Hey, that's interesting. How in the world could they have an outhouse out in the middle of nowhere? After all, everyone that goes in it would freeze." "No," the engineer answered. "Reverend, you won't believe how much these outhouses cost. The very one you're looking at right over there." I looked across the general direction he was nodding to. "Well," I said, we used to build our houses for nothing. We'd use scrap lumber on the farm." The engineer nodded. "Yes, what you'd do back on the farm and what was the sensible thing to do, that was the sensible thing to do, but we're not allowed to do that up here. We can't even dig any holes in this tundra to put an outhouse on. We're told that that would destroy the ecology. The regulation is that we must have these special outhouses hauled in." I was finding it hard to believe my ears. Here was a highly intelligent man telling me that officialdom was of such a nature that apparently huge sums of money must be spent on these special outhouses. I turned to the engineer and asked, "Well, what's so special about them?" He answered, "The first thing is that is special is that they cost $10,000 each." I looked at him in surprise. "Wait a minute, sir," I said. "You're talking about an outhouse. You're not talking about buying a Mercedes-Benz." Then he gave me a smile and said, "As a matter of fact, that outhouse has a Mercedes-Benz diesel engine in it." When I said $10,000, I meant the engine. I didn't mean the engine. That's extra, of course. "Come on now, explain it to me," I answered. "What's all this nonsense that you're trying to pull over?" The engineer assured me that it was not nonsense. He said, "You see, that's an entirely self-contained incinerator unit. And if you ever saw the black smoke coming out of that stack of that thing, and then you smelled the aroma, you'd really know what contamination was. It surely is contaminating the air and the whole ecology, too." I asked, "How does the incineration process work?" "Well," the engineer answered, "when a man does his business in the outhouse, it goes down to the bottom, and that diesel engine automatically cranks up. By electrical and other means, it completely incinerates everything. He pointed to a pipe that came out of the outhouse. It shoots out the pipe up there, and as a result, it's not supposed to contaminate anything. Well, I can only say it certainly contaminates my nostrils all the time. Right then, I knew that my own nostrils were being contaminated in no uncertain way. And while I was there, I always knew that when someone was doing his business, I found myself annoyed at the idea of a diesel engine automatically cranking up for such a purpose. I must confess, too, that whenever I go to the gas pumps and buy fuel, I remember that my own pocketbook has been contaminated by those outhouses at $10,000 each, plus the cost of the Mercedes-Benz engine, of course. $10,000 plus for an outhouse with a Mercedes-Benz engine thrown in, just because they didn't want to fertilize the tundra. That was bureaucracy gone mad. For what purpose? We shall see as we proceed. We've talked about the $2 million falcon's nest, the $10,000 outhouses. There were other similar incidences that can be multiplied, and taken together, they involved a huge sum of money. Another method to add to the price of the pipeline, and again, to the price that you pay, the individual will pay at the gas pump, was the almost incredible use of fines. On one occasion, a vehicle with sightseers on board ran off the road to let a truck go by. No damage was done. There was nothing off the road, just the tundra. Remember that it would take an axe to break through the tundra. Nevertheless, there was a fine of $10,000 levied because that vehicle ran off the road. Of course, it was not the sightseers that got fined, but the ARCO company. People living in the lower 48 will find it hard to believe that such practices continued, but they surely did. Another case was where a pickup truck drove into the river to turn around. A security guard had locked the gate, and so this was the way that the driver solved his own problem. Again, the ARCO company got fined $10,000 for not making an adequate turnaround. They hurt nothing driving their vehicle into the river, but it is certainly impossible to figure out why they should have been fined, but fined they were. The amounts of these fines were announced in the paper very often, and there would be a small write-up. It didn't make big news, for the policy seemed to be to keep these matters in low key. It is ultimately the poor guy who buys gas for his automobile that pays these fines of $10,000 and more for the most trivial offenses against the huge number of regulations to which the oil companies were subjected. I hope you folks are getting this. Not only were there very heavy fines, but also they dragged the work out. One section of road was supposed to be a five-week project, but because of government meddling, it was about 3 months before it was finished. The government tinkered with the administration, fined the company, and stopped them in all sorts of ways. They told them what they could and could not do, when they could work and when they could not work. At one time, there were 22 government monitors working on that one section of road. They came from such departments as the Department of the Interior, the Department of the Fisheries and Game, and the U.S. Geographic Coastal Survey. Most of them were federal workers, but some were state workers also. Those 22 workers were running around surveying the same stretch of road at the same time, day after day. While that stretch of road was being built, some 18 fines were levied in a three-month period. Every one of those fines was for at least $10,000. The company that had the contract for that stretch of road ran over their estimated budget by $5 million. The cost overrun almost broke them, and the ARCO company had to come back and reimburse them to keep them from going bankrupt. There was no doubt that this strict enforcement of often ridiculous and excessive regulations, the attempt was being made to bankrupt all the oil companies. Often regulations were changed. A good example of that was when the rules for going on the tundra were altered. It used to be that you could not go on the tundra unless there had been 30 days of consecutive freeze and a specified amount of snow. Then the authorities would issue a permit, and you can go anywhere you liked on the tundra. After all, you cannot hurt it. Then the regulations were changed to make it so that you could not go on the tundra for any reason without a permit. Anytime you wanted to go on the tundra, you had to have a specific permit registered with the state, and it would take weeks to get one. Of course, people had to had to be paid to process those permits. This new regulation was considered by many people to be absurd, for there were all too many occasions that it was necessary to go on the tundra in the normal course of events to check out a marker or to repair a light pole or for many other legitimate reasons. The tundra is not easily scored or damaged. You could drive all over it right through the winter and never see where you had driven. You need an axe to break it up. The authorities made it essential to get these permits. They were state people because the land is state-owned, not owned by the federal government. The same controls extended even to the dumps associated with the camps. One oil company executive told me that there were three state ecologists monitoring the dump where he worked. They lived at Atwood, and there were often three of them employed with no other work than the monitoring of the dump. All that place, there is only one certified landfill in the North Slope. One day these three monitors came to the dump and someone had dumped some spoiled wiener packs, hot dogs, and of course hot dogs are supposed to be buried. On this occasion, for some reason, the garbage man had picked up one of the bags and got the whole bag of spoiled hot dogs and dumped them on the dump. These three people found the hot dogs and they fined the company $10,000 for throwing hot dogs away. Their argument was that food should not be thrown on the dump because it would attract bears. The fact was that this was a legitimate mistake, for the company operated its incinerator and a man was paid to burn all that stuff. He just did not get it done that particular day, and so the company was fined $10,000. The same company executive who indignantly told me about the hot dogs also pointed out that it was not permitted to salvage anything from the dumps. Often it would cost large sums of money to freight iron, copper, and brass to the site, but it was then buried at the dump. Nothing could be moved out, even if it was urgently required, for example, for repair purposes. When the fines were levied, there was little the offending parties could do about it. The fines were levied, and the amounts were learned 2 or 3 months after the incident. There is an old saying, one rule for the rich and another for the poor. It certainly was true, and there was one way to apply these regulations to the employees of the oil companies and another way when it came to the state employees. We just said that the company was fined for allowing a bag of hot dogs to accidentally be thrown on the dump because it might attract bears. Yet some of their own employees did worse things with food lying around, and it did, in fact, attract bears. Then those employees shot the bears, and nothing was done. No action was taken against them, not even a fine. The oil company people were not allowed to participate in hunting or fishing. They were fired if they got caught. A different set of rules applied to state employees. Folks, I hope you were paying attention. I hope you see some of what we were trying to get at, and some of the reason why you're paying so much money today. We got to go. We're out of time. Join me Friday. I'll be back, and maybe I'll continue some more of this. It depends on what happens during the week. Chris will be back with you tomorrow. I appreciate you joining us tonight. God bless you. Have a good night.
When you turn and find that you're all alone, and the velvet wall the night moves in, wraps around you like a wall of stone, just when your final prayer has...
Most Americans want our government to control our borders, especially since 9/11. But amazingly, some political leaders want to do away with borders entirely. Whether the American people agree